seek him here, they seek him there. His clothes are loud, but never square. It will make or break him, so he's got to buy the best, 'cause he's a dedicated follower of fashion. And when he does his little rounds round the boutiques of London town.
NashvilleFM.org, this is The Final Straw, and I'm Bursts. The show is also heard on KXCF, KWTF, and KOWALPFM. As I announced last week, Asheville Free Media and its parent nonprofit, Friends of Community Radio, are now embarking on a fundraising campaign to build our broadcast tower here in Asheville on top of the Indigo Hotel. We estimate that the cost of getting up on the air, what with red tape and lawyers and stuff, will be around $45,000. If you care to donate or find out more about the campaign, check out the link on AshevilleFM.org. While on the website, you can also check out some of the other great shows at the station, and if you live in the Asheville area, consider clicking the Join Us tab to get involved in the station at this exciting time. This week's episode is a blast back to the past. It's an interview with Christian Williams from January of 2012 about his research into the anarchism of Oscar Wilde. We'll get into that interview after a few news items. This and other archives of the show can be found at thefinalstrawradio.noblogs.org about a week after they broadcast on ashevillefm.org. And you can contact us for commentary or criticism or questions or whatever at thefinalstrawradio@riseup.net. You may note that this week's episode doesn't feature commentary by Sean Swain. Well, if you hanker for that man's wit and biting critique, check out seanswain.org for some of his writings and audio. We'll have an audio segment from him next week. So I'd like to really quickly read a letter. So this was available on Sabotage Media, which you can find out more of that at sabotagemedia.anarchia.org. That's ANARKHIA.org. It's a letter from Amélie, who was one of the anarchists arrested in Mexico City. Well, it explains during the letter, but I think it's a really well-written piece. It does come from February 23rd, Santa Marta Prison and the DF. On the evening of January 5th, I was arrested with my comrades Fallon and Carlos for allegedly attacking the office of the Federal Secretary of Communications and Transportation of Mexico and also a Nissan dealership. Windows were broken and Molotov cocktails were thrown inside the ministry, according to what the evidence says, and inside the new cars of the dealership. Damages are evaluated to more than 70,000 pesos at the ministry and 100,000 pesos at Nissan. Indeed, I'm an anarchist and live in Montreal, Canada. I was traveling in Mexico, and now my trip is being prolonged some time. After being arrested, they locked us up for 96 hours and then transferred us at the Federal Center of Arriago without prior having seen a judge. We were held captive for 40 days in a cell. 23 hours a day, a cigarette a day, smoked in 10 minutes. 3 meals per day, but with only 10 minutes to eat at each time, without talking. Not allowed to have a pencil. 9 minutes of phone per day. In short, it was a long wait. And there was nothing more than the Mexican quote-unquote telenovelas unquote, playing on TV all day. Luckily, our friend sent us some books. Thanks. I don't know how I could have survived without it. On day 40, the General Prosecutor of the Republic, PGR Federal, transferred our files to the PJC, State Police, because they have no evidence to charge us of a federal crime. Thus, since February 17th, Fallon and I are at Santa Marta, State Prison for Women in Mexico City, where we were transferred, and Carlos is at Oriente Prison, State Penitentiary for Men, 20 minutes from us. Here, it's a micro-society surrounded by cement and barbed wire, but where you can do as you wish inside. At the moment of writing this text, it's 7:30 a.m. I'm in the yard, and I'm looking at the sun rising behind the watchtower occupying the scenery. Actually, I almost feel like it's in the yard of an apartment block when I look at the building with the clothes hanging out from the windows without bars. There's plenty of pigeons, garbage cans, yellowed grass, barbed wire, and there's plenty of people with their own stories. Prisons are necessary for maintaining social peace, as are cops. It is the domination and control that permits this sickening world to persist. Prison means fear, the unknown, shame, solitude, isolation. Society is the domestication of individuals into quote-unquote good citizens. Thus, my strength as individual takes root in the refusal of fear being a limit in my life. For sure I'm afraid, like everyone, of many things, but my desire of freedom is stronger. Fear is often constructed and is deconstructed when we face it. What's important is to see further, beyond the boundaries and borders, beyond the walls, mountains, rivers, and oceans. I don't know how long I'm here for, but I don't feel sorry for myself. I'm confident that outside, the struggle goes on, and people meet, love each other, hate each other, live, damn it. In fact, I'm not comfortable with people focusing on our case without engaging their own struggles in their own contexts. I believe that the best solidarity is built in the sharing of individuals and collective strength. The worst thing for me would be that nothing goes on outside while we were held captive. But I know my friends continue despite the difficulty we must face. My reality as an anarchist in prison is a fact among others with which we have to adapt. The most difficult is often to maintain and protect bonds of trust with comrades whom we have an affinity with for long-term thinking. When it's possible, unimaginable possibilities emerge. In that sense, my ideas and analyses remain the same as outside. That's why I don't feel like changing my discourse to get people's support. I greatly appreciate the efforts of solidarity that have been done till now, although I distance myself from certain initiatives that have been taken in solidarity with us. In Montreal, during a demo that took place in front of the Mexican consulate, the speech denounced torture and human rights violations by the Mexican state. The UN was mentioned in a reformist and progressive tone. Honestly, I appreciate that many people feel concerned about our case, but I refuse to use that illusory reformist discourse. As I see it, injustice, torture, and human rights violations are integral parts of the world as it is. Rights are regulated by the state and are suspended at any moment as needed. Furthermore, it provokes democratic ideology, rights for citizens, the biggest of illusions. And most of all, to support our ideas with references to instances of power like the UN cannot build a strong anti-authoritarian struggle. It's not by trying to influence public opinion with reformist discourse that we will build strong foundations for the struggle, for a struggle impossible to recuperate. I must say, I honestly have nothing to do with the student and worker unions, and that even in the quote-unquote syndicalisme de combat, translated combat unionism, very fashionable back home in Montreal. Those organizations are formal and bureaucratic. They reproduce direct democracy. Those are the same structures I want to destroy, which impose distance between individuals and the way they relate to the world and to the living. Formality, bureaucracy, law, and institutionalization transform the relationship between people. They immobilize the constant possibilities of transformation exactly as political parties do. They try to organize and lead the, quote, formless masses, unquote. Therefore, there's an obvious contradiction. We've received support from student associations in Quebec. For my part, I have no problems with accepting money, which will no doubt help us get out of prison. But I must say that these organizations have nothing revolutionary about them. They're rotten to the core. They're based on Maoist organizational structures and are totally formal with their politicians' procedural code. This language is incomprehensible. Charismatic speakers manipulate the votes of the masses by expressing what the majority wants to hear rather than speaking from the heart. Crowds of 100,000 people march like zombies, sing and repeat the same reformist slogans, and then return home to their daily routine. In the situation in which I find myself, waiting for my sentence or my release, to express openly that I am an anarchist can put me in a precarious situation. I choose to do so anyway. Many times, I felt the need to communicate with other anarchists who have experienced a similar situation. When confronting state repression, there are several ways to react. I think that using a moderate discourse provides privileges, such as getting out of jail faster, obtaining financing, or social acceptance. But I think that as long as the words and deeds will be moderate, it will be difficult to spread insurrectional and anti-authoritarian practices. That is why it is important to communicate my ideas openly and knowingly. I do not know how long I will be locked up here, but one thing is certain. It will be for a lifetime. It will not be for a lifetime. Thank goodness. I am fortunate to have great friends and comrades in struggles, and I do not feel alone. The struggle and courage are found first in oneself. There is a universe of possibilities, here as elsewhere. All forms of domination are to be fought, those that create the structures and institutions as much as those who interfere in our relationships. There is no heaven or perfect world. Freedom is a permanent movement and conflict, in confrontation with the world of images, symbols, and appearances. Freedom is the destruction of the structures of domination over our lives. In Mexico, Montreal, France, Vancouver, United States, Spain, Greece, Chile, Egypt, Belgium, Italy, Germany, England, Holland, I greet my friends and comrades of struggle. For total freedom, I wish for links to be forged in the struggle. In solidarity with Carlos Chivo and Fallon, with love, down with all prison walls, Amelie. And also linked down here, if you want to write Amelie and Fallon, I would suggest you check out Anarchist News. And the second story down at the moment is, actually the first story down at the moment, is Mexico 5E. And that's the name for those defendants. Letter from Amelie. In other good news, as I'm narrating into the radio right now, the Trayvon 2 scored a partial victory. So this was published 5 days ago on fireworksbayarea.com, which is the Bay Area Anarchist Counterinformation site. Despite overwhelming evidence of the defendant's innocence in what is now being called the Trayvon 2 case, the judge in the pretrial hearing here ruled on March 6 to continue the case to trial. However, he lowered the charges of the two well-known activists, Hannibal Shakur and Tanzin Doha, from felonies to misdemeanors over the prosecutor's objections. Supporters once again packed the courtroom to support the two, who were among many arrested during massive protests after a Florida court acquitted George Zimmerman in the killing of Trayvon Martin. Shakur and Doha, both young men of color and Muslims, are the only ones still facing charges. The hearing, which lasted most of the day, was scheduled for the Wiley-Manuel Courthouse in downtown Oakland. After supporters flooded the courtroom, not literally, the judge announced an immediate move to the Renee C. Davidson Courthouse a mile away. Supporters spontaneously decided to march to the new location. Two Oakland police officers gave somewhat conflicting testimony in which each of them claimed to have seen a different one of the two defendants break a plate glass window. They each claimed to have never lost sight of the person when they who they saw break the window before arresting him. One of the two, who was watching from 65 feet away, said that there were 200 people in the crowd of protesters. The other estimated the crowd at 50 to 100 people and said he was 40 feet away. Anyway, for more details into this case and the attempted railroading of the state, by the state, of these two activists and, as said, young men of color who are also Muslims, you should check out the article that's on Fireworks, and also search in a search engine for Support the Trayvon 2, and you'll come to a support page for them. In any case, I now present for your enjoyment the episode of The Final Straw from January 29th of 2012, which was an interview with Christian Williams, a volunteer with Rose City Cop Watch in Portland, also author of Our Enemies in Blue and American Methods and other zines and books. And more information of, or more of his writings can be found at christianwilliams.com. Today we're going to be speaking with Christian Williams, the author of the books Our Enemies in Blue, Police and Power in America, and American Methods, The Logic of Domination. Christian Williams has written articles on policing and torture that have also appeared in Counterpunch, New Politics, In These Times, and in the collection Confrontations. Mr. Williams is also a volunteer with Rose City Cop Watch in Portland, Oregon. In addition to researching state violence, Williams frequently writes about comics and cartooning and is a regular contributor to the Comics Journal. Today we'll be speaking with Mr. Williams on yet another project he's thrown himself into, a book about Oscar Wilde and anarchism.
Considering how much of a departure this seems to be from your other published work, what inspired this endeavor?
Well, in some ways it's a departure, and in some ways it's a return. I studied literature as an undergraduate, and I've been an admirer of Wilde's for, I think, literally my whole life. Like, I remember reading his fairy tales when I was a child. And more particularly, after writing American Methods, the process of spending a couple of
today
years
we're going to be speaking with Christian Williams, the author of the books Our Enemies in Blue, Police and Power in America, and American Methods, The Logic of Domination. Christian Williams has written articles on policing and torture that have also appeared in Counterpunch, New Politics.
More particularly, after writing American Methods, the process of spending a couple of years thinking about torture constantly was a pretty good motivator for me to try to do something else next. I really wanted to spend some time thinking and writing about something that I liked rather than something abhorrent. And then, of course, it turned out not to be that much of a departure after all, because the first substantial piece that I got about Wilde into print was the long essay for the Institute for Anarchist Studies on his experience in prison, which led me very quickly back to a lot of my thinking about the history of the criminal justice system and the sort of abuses that are intrinsic to that.
Could you give a little thumbnail sketch of Oscar Wilde's life?
Sure. He lived in the late 19th century, was born in Ireland to a family of landed gentry, was educated in Oxford, where he studied classics and did exceedingly well, left Oxford and endeavored to become kind of a cross between a public intellectual and a popular entertainer, immediately declared himself a professor of aesthetics, and was sent on a tour across the United States to explain sort of the philosophy of the aestheticist movement, which was this movement in art and philosophy that is best remembered now for the slogan of art for art's sake. And returned to England after that, wrote a series of essays and poems and plays, hit his commercial peak with four society plays, which are what he's best remembered for now, The Importance Being Honest being the most famous one. At the peak of his success, he was arrested for a charge called gross indecency with other male persons, which was basically the criminal offense for homosexuality. And he was put on trial, convicted, sent to prison for 2 years, when he left prison, was largely disgraced, went into exile in France, and from there wrote a poem called The Ballad of Reading Jail, which in terms of his poetry is by far the most successful piece that he wrote. And then he died in 1900, probably from complications to an injury that he received while he was in prison.
That was the injury to the ear?
Yeah. He was sick basically the entire time that he was in prison, but even though he was sick, he was still, for some of that time, required to perform hard labor, as well as attend chapel every day and sort of the regular prison routine. And one day, when he was very sick, he was still forced to go to chapel, and while there, he passed out and struck his head and injured his ear, which became infected, and he had intermittent infections for the rest of his life, and it probably contributed to his early death.
In an article that you wrote for New Politics about a year ago, you state very early on that you know of only two instances when Wilde explicitly refers to himself as an anarchist in published works. How much of Wilde's use of the term anarchist for himself and for others is an aesthetic expression, and how much of it shows self-identification with ideas like an end to coercion, for instance, the state and prison systems, and to capitalism?
Well, the term that he used more often was socialism, which he didn't use in contradistinction to anarchism, but he was part of this milieu that included artists and writers and political radicals of various kinds. He was friends, for example, with William Morris, who was probably best characterized as a libertarian socialist, although was heavily Marxian in his thinking. He was also friends with Peter Kropotkin, who, of course, is the most famous anarchist of his time. And he knew George Bernard Shaw and Cunningham Graham and just some Irish nationalists, just the whole range of radical figures at the time. And he used the term socialism to really just sort of like absorb that whole milieu, which was pretty standard for the period. And so when in the couple of times when he referred to himself as an anarchist, it's pretty clear that he wasn't sort of staking out new territory. He was clarifying his position. And his most famous political writing is an essay called The Soul of Man Under Socialism. And if you read it, it's fairly clear to someone who's familiar with the political spectrum what kind of socialism he's talking about. I mean, he specifically talks about the need for socialism to do away with government, and that no kind of compulsion is acceptable, and that work needs to be voluntary if it is to be fine, and that sort of thing. And it's really just, to someone familiar with those ideas, it's clear that what he's presenting is an anarchist vision, although in the essay he doesn't use the term at all, which is both understandable and also fairly interesting.
You would say that Wilde's use of the term socialism is pretty comparable to the use of the so-called Haymarket Martyrs about 10 years before?
Well, I haven't done a careful examination of their rhetoric, but roughly, yes. And in fact, he took an interest in the Haymarket case, so it's interesting that you mention that in particular. Around the time of their sentencing, George Bernard Shaw was circulating a petition for leniency and totally failed to collect signatures on it. I mean, I think ultimately he collected, like, he was looking for prominent men of letters and science and whatever, and was just being refused everywhere that he went until he went to Wilde, who signed it without a second thought. Ultimately, he ended up with like 8 or 9 signatures on the petition. But yeah, early on, Wilde took an interest in the Haymarket affair. But, you know, also the, Kropotkin, a little while later, wrote the entry on anarchism for the Encyclopedia Britannica, and in that describes anarchism as being the far left wing of the socialist movement. And that was pretty normal at the time. I mean, the kinds of rhetorical distinctions that we draw now really don't map very neatly onto the 19th century. And to offer one example, the Socialist League was largely anarchist and, in fact, divided more or less among sort of anarchist and Marxist lines, but it was the anarchist who kept the league. The Marxists left. Similarly, the Social Democratic Federation was the hotbed of revolutionary activity in London at the time, and it included both anarchists and Marxists. But, of course, now we associate social democracy with sort of, you know, European-style welfare states. So the ideological distinctions were not really as set as they are now, and there was more interchange of ideas and more circulation within the overall milieu of people who had different ideologies and different political tendencies, which, you know, I think was probably a healthier kind of intellectual environment than some of the sectarianism and dogmatism that we see now.
What, therefore, did Wilde mean when he spoke of the state in that aforementioned essay, The Soul of Man Under Socialism?
It's a good question. It's not really clear what he means, but it's pretty clear it's not a state. I mean, he says that the state in socialism has a very specific role, and that role is not government. That role is being a voluntary association to manufacture the necessities of life. Okay, so it seems like the term state was either badly chosen or he was being deliberately ironic. And, you know, his rhetorical strategy almost always was very paradoxical, and that also shows up in that essay where he begins by asserting that the main benefit to be achieved by socialism is the development of individualism. And so he you know, invokes this idea of a socialist state and then immediately moves against any idea of government or compulsion. And it seems like, you know, to the degree that he had anything specific in mind at all, what he had in mind was a sort of federation of voluntary cooperatives that were going to produce, you know, the sorts of things that everybody needs, but that are not, that are best handled collectively. The sanitation and the food production and the, you know, basic kind of consumer goods and that kind of thing, I believe is what he had in mind. But what he definitely didn't have in mind, and he's explicit about this, is that any sort of, like, bureaucratic mechanism that was going to regulate or control the individual conduct within the society.
Earlier on, you mentioned in that same essay that in some of his earlier poetry, he had railed against the masses. It had seemed like he didn't have very much faith in human nature as a whole. And yet, later on, you point out that in, like, he does say, however, I have more in common with the masses of people who die upon the barricades than with the kings.
Yeah, his earlier politics were more ambivalent than his later. In a way, you can definitely see his family background coming through there. And on both sides of that ambivalence. His family, as I mentioned, were landed gentry in Ireland. They were Irish Protestants. And his father was knighted and was a physician who worked for some of the royal families of Europe. And his mother, on the other hand, was an important Irish nationalist and wrote inflammatory articles for a newspaper called The Nation and provoked a trial of one of the editors over the incendiary remarks of one of her essays. And Wilde really took both of those positions in hand. Like, he maintained throughout his life kind of an aristocratic outlook, which early on was very tied up with snobbery and sort of class privilege. And as his politics became more radical, became more generalized in that sort of classic anarchist fashion, where he really imagined a society in which, like, everyone was a kind of aristocrat, right? At the same time, he also had this born and bred kind of Irish nationalism, was therefore hostile to the British government on principle, and was very critical of imperialism, and was sympathetic with, you know, certain kinds of uprisings. I suspect that his sympathy for people like the Haymarket defendants was partly influenced by his older sympathy with the Irish nationalist movement. And I think his from the basis of wanting Ireland to be independent from England, that also developed as he got older into a more generalizable value for autonomy and value for sort of self-regulation rather than being ruled from afar or being ruled from above. So really the contradictions in his position that we see when he was a very young man in many ways inform the more coherent politics that he develops later on, for what that's worth.
You also wrote that article that was commissioned by the Institute for Anarchist Studies entitled A Criminal with a Noble Face, Oscar Wilde's Encounter with the Victorian Jail. And in it, you created a detailed picture of Wilde's experiences in prison. from his visiting of an American penitentiary in Nebraska in 1882 through his own imprisonment in 1895 on charges of gross indecency, as you mentioned, and through his later life. How did the development of Wilde's political philosophy shape his experience of these institutions and vice versa?
It had a pretty profound effect. That earliest instance, the visit to the jail in Nebraska, he was really, he could pity the prisoners, but he could not identify with them. And as he, slightly after that, he wrote a review of a book of verse by a man named Wilford Blunt, who was in prison for some political offense. I forget exactly the nature of it. And Wilde begins that essay by sort of praising the effect that incarceration had on Blunt's writing, that before he had been this sort of shallow rhymer, and you know, the experience of prison had turned him into this, you know, deep and profound poet. By 1891, when he wrote *Soul and Inner Socialism*, he was dismissing the idea of punishment wholesale. He was saying, you know, the worst possible remedy for crime is punishment, and that when we look back through history at the evil that's been done, we realize that most of it has been done by good people trying to punish bad people and not by the bad people themselves, and really had just wholesale condemnation of it, but not in particularly much detail. Once he had been to prison, he had a much firmer grasp on what it was actually like, and that led to, and so he wrote, as I mentioned, The Ballad of Reading Jail, which is a sort of fictionalized account of an execution that took place while Wilde was in prison. And then he also wrote two very long letters to the Daily Chronicle detailing some of the abuses that he had witnessed and the dreadful conditions, and making a case for some very specific reforms that would improve the conditions of the prisoners. And that was it's interesting that all of his writing after he left prison was about prison. Like the two letters to the Daily Chronicle and The Ballad of Reading Jail were really all he produced between his release and his death. It's also interesting that in those letters to the Daily Chronicle, he takes the approach of specifically advocating reforms, because a few years earlier in Soul and Manner of Socialism, he spent quite a bit of the essay arguing against the possibility of any reforms at all, saying that reforms don't cure the disease, they merely prolong it, and they delay the sort of inevitable crisis that would bring real change. I think having seen what a difference some decent sanitation or a few additional library books or the ability to see and talk with one's visitors makes in the experience of someone who's locked in prison, I think that shifted his thinking on that seriously. I mean, he certainly didn't become a reformist in the, like, narrow and pejorative sense, because he even says in those letters where he's urging the reforms that no amount of reform is enough to save these institutions, but that they're just irredeemable. But he also notes that as long as they're there, there are things that can be done that can improve the lot of people who are locked in them. And so that was an important change, and a move away from his earlier utopianism toward a more sort of practical application to his ideals.
You argue in that essay also that he pointedly said that it was, in fact, the prison system that created criminals, not only exacerbating any issues that would have gone, like, people would have gone in there with, but created the class of criminals and criminalized a whole class of people by imposing Victorian's values upon them and criminalizing social activities that would not have been criminalized otherwise.
I think he meant really sort of two things there, which you've outlined pretty well. One being that it's the law, like, I'm going to butcher this quote, but he makes reference somewhere to desires that the law makes monstrous. And, you know, he was referring to his own case in that it wasn't anything inherent in, you know, his so-called crimes that was monstrous. It was the evaluation of the law that, like, cast them that way. And then there was, more sort of prosaically, this notion that was actually very common at the time, that the experience of going to prison sort of taught people criminality, and that the the metaphor at the time was that prisons were like universities for crime. And it wasn't just anarchists or socialists or even critics of the institution who particularly saw it that way. A lot of mainstream criminologists put forward similar kinds of arguments, that the institution had the effect on the individual of making them criminal, whereas before they may have simply been acting out of desperation or bad judgment or something. He meant, I think, both things at the same time in talking about the prison as a manufacturer of crime. He also meant, I guess the third thing he meant more broadly, was that the whole system of coercion and punishment and government had a particular kind of class function, that it kept certain people desperate and precarious and unable to meet their needs through legitimate means, and therefore it had the effect of creating the system of private property had the effect that it preserves has the effect of creating people who have no other way of surviving but to steal or extort or whatever it was. And so he also in the Solid Manner of Socialism in particular, he projects that sort of flaw of criminality back onto the society that creates it, and puts the responsibility more on the social system than on the individual.
In your opinion, how would Wilde view today's prisons in the United States? For example, there's been changes like the breaking of rocks or the untwining of rope, and Wilde's experience has been changed for routing service calls for corporations. Solitary confinement for most has been shifted to a precautionary act for a few quote-unquote dangerous criminals. And Victorian sentiments and values are no longer the outspoken goals of the current criminal justice system.
Well, let's see. I think he would definitely approve of the introduction of indoor plumbing. At the time, the...
Buckets weren't good enough for him?
Yeah, at the time, the sanitation conditions were basically that you had a... I'm going to try to do this without swearing. Had a bucket to dispose of your waste in, and it stayed there in the corner until the morning when you were hopefully allowed out for a few minutes to dump it out. So, in some very practical ways, conditions have improved. On the other hand, I don't think he could have possibly anticipated, nobody anticipated the explosion of the prison population that we've seen in the United States. And it's hard to know what he would have made of the sort of change in our prison philosophy. On the one hand, it's less hypocritical in that prisons don't really pretend to be rehabilitating people. But on the other hand, they just become that much more exercises in cruelty. One thing that, the 100 years of reform, 110 years of reform since his death definitely demonstrates is that he was right in his prediction that the kinds of reforms that he offered could improve the conditions, but could not actually justify the institution. Now, for the most part, children are not locked in the same facilities as adults. Now, for the most part, there is indoor plumbing. There, is adequate light. Until very recently, there was not a great prevalence of solitary confinement, although we seem to be moving backward toward Victorian standards in that regard. And yet, the prisons, like all of the general criticisms that he mounted, remain true. Like, there's still these exercises in cruelty. They still, degrade the people who are locked in them. They still, and for that matter, the people who administer them, they still are this kind of just brutality that society exercises on people that it's labeled criminals in the name of, you know, the goodness of the rest of us. And that's just inherent to the institution, which he recognized even as he was advocating for the more modest reforms.
So Oscar Wilde was found guilty of gross indecency between male persons and served a 2-year sentence. How did this case come up? What validity was there to the charge, and what were Oscar Wilde's sexual politics? Was Wilde, in fact, a homosexual?
Well, that's a nest of complicated questions. It came up... Okay, so the simple answer to was Wilde a homosexual is yes, although that is not a term that he would have recognized because it didn't have any currency at the time. It were, to some degree, being anachronistic, talking about homosexuality at that point. The term that he would have used was a Uranian, which is a reference to Plato's Symposium, and actually ties in with his classical education and an argument that one of his teachers at Oxford, Walter Pater, made about the role of homosexuality in ancient Greek culture. But yes, Wilde was a lover of men, and in one man in particular, the Lord Alfred Douglas, was in the midst of a long-running family feud with his father, the Marquess of Queensbury. And Queensbury, as partly out of sort of petty vindictiveness and hatred for his son, and partly out of a sort of moral commitment to, you know, saving his son from this, as he saw it, like, degenerate lifestyle, was single-mindedly devoted to breaking the friendship between Wilde and Douglas. Over the course of several months, was becoming increasingly antagonistic toward toward Wilde, including trying to disrupt his plays and showing up at his house and threatening him, various kinds of sort of public and private insults. And the point at which the peak of this was a card that Queensbury left at Wilde's club not an envelope, which became important later, but was addressed to Oscar Wilde posing as a sodomite. And although Queensbury misspelled sodomite, so Oscar Wilde posing as a sodomite, which was an interesting kind of accusation. Wilde felt like he had to respond to this, but the only way he could respond to it was to prosecute Queensbury for libel. It was, of course, dangerous to prosecute him for libel because the accusation was essentially true. But he was counting on the fact that Queensbury probably couldn't prove that it was true, and he thought that if he prosecuted Queensbury for libel, then that would sort of stifle his campaign against Wilde. Of course, that totally backfired. Like, Queensbury had hired private detectives and had done a lot of research on Wilde and who he knew, and Wilde had been previously blackmailed before by desperate young men of the lower classes with whom he had had affairs. And Queensbury found some of them who were, though they had been bought off the first time, were now willing to, you know, talk to be bought off the second time. So the first trial Wilde actually brought against Queensbury, and Queensbury just hit him with this huge amount of evidence. And then that led to Wilde dropping the charges of libel, but also he found himself arrested and prosecuted for gross indecency. The part of why it's interesting that Queensbury accused him of posing as a sodomite was that had he just accused him of being a sodomite, he would have had a much harder time. Sodomy was considered an extremely serious offense. It was still common at the time for clergymen and moralists and, you know, newspaper editors to refer to it as worse than murder. A generation before, it had been a capital offense. By Wilde's time, it was still accompanied by a life sentence. So he was convicted. He was accused of a lesser crime of gross indecency, which had a 2-year sentence. had he been convicted of sodomy, he would have had a life sentence. As it was, sodomy was much harder to prove in the courts at the time, as it required the testimony of a witness, which in almost every conceivable case would therefore also be implicating themselves, right? So it was very hard to make a sodomy case. Had Queensberry accused him of being a sodomite, Wilde's disingenuous prosecution of him for libel may have worked in terms of squashing the scandal. However, instead he accused him of posing as a sodomite, which is interesting because in a certain respect, Wilde did also do that. I mean, a lot of his work is shot through with homoeroticism, and he had written a long sort of short story / essay called The Portrait of Mr. W.H., which is basically a philosophical defense of homosexuality and pointing to the cultural contributions of same-sex love from, you know, Greece through the Renaissance to the present. And Wilde was very fond of saying ambiguous, outrageous things, which certainly implied, like, often had the implication that he was sexually attracted or interested in seducing young men of various kinds. So there was really, Wilde didn't have any way of defending against the accusation of posing as a sodomite. And in fact, he, you know, at the end of the day, he was a sodomite posing as a respectable middle-class husband as a sodomite. Now, how that all ties into Wilde's sexual politics, I mean, to some degree it's pretty apparent on the surface. I mean, he, on the one hand, he was vocally challenging the sexual mores of his time, and he also explicitly made an argument in favor of the sort of cultural contribution of homosexuality and in favor of cultural acceptance of homosexuality. He was also involved in with a circle of people who were sort of in the process of forming what we would now consider the homosexual identity. I mean, but before this point, it was homosexuality was considered a crime or a sin, but it wasn't considered, there wasn't like a type of person that was a homosexual. And they were in the process of, and I think as they would put it, resuscitating that identity, sort of pulling it out of, you know, little bits of Greek culture and pulling it out of like little parts of the Renaissance, projecting this this continuity that they were then also part of. And then on the other hand, though, he couldn't just declare for this. And a lot of people since then have looked back and said, well, you know, clearly Wilde himself said, you know, that he went wrong at the place where he appealed to the law to try to protect him. And a lot of people just kind of wish that he had, you know, made a brave stand and, you know, declared himself homosexual and, you know, that he would have been more of a kind of pure martyr. But I think they're forgetting how dangerous a game that really would have been. I mean, he was already sort of as close to the edge of that precipice as he could manage. And at the end of the day, he misjudged it and fell over. That said, like, when, even in the trial, he was asked about this line in one of Lord Alfred Douglas's poems, which referred to the love that dared not speak its name. And he gave this very eloquent speech in his defense, in defense of the love that dared not speak his name, which was really sort of, I don't know, the moral high point of the whole affair, but was, you know, badly considered in terms of trying to defend himself against posing as a sodomite.
So during the proceedings of the case, yeah, Charles Gill said, "What is the love that dare not speak its name?" And Wilde responded, "The love that dare not speak its name in this century is such a great affection of an elder for a younger man as there was between David and Jonathan, such as Plato made the very basis of his philosophy, and such as you find in the sonnets of Michelangelo and Shakespeare." So then he was specifically a proponent of man boy love, or like, and the relationship.
What do you mean by that? He was generally attracted to men who were much younger than him. I mean, The first male lover that we know of was Robbie Ross, who then became his lifelong friend and then became his literary executor after his death and wrote biographies of him and such. Ross was, I believe, 17, and Wilde was, I believe, 35 at the point where that relationship happened. And Douglas was in his early 20s during the time of that relationship. So there was more than a decade between them. Of the lower class men that he had relationships with, usually with some sort of financial component, although it's not, there was a very thin line at the time between sort of friendly generosity and prostitution and blackmail. But those men tended to be in their teens. So on the other hand, the age of consent at the time was 13, and the, you know, most working class people left home in their very early adolescence. So these were typically, you know, people who were, you know, on their own, not living with their parents, working jobs, or wishing they had jobs to work, one or the other. And, you know, in most respects, sort of adult members of society. Although now we look at them and we see teenagers. So it's an interesting question to kind of consider. How, you know, in some ways we tend to look back on this case and feel kind of superior because of the progress we've made. Like, well, I mean, of course we would never put Wilde in prison now for acts of gross indecency, but we very well may put him in prison for violating age of consent laws, right? And probably for a much longer time. That said, he also didn't, to say that he advocated that is maybe not really too strong, but too narrow, because he didn't advocate any one type of relationship or one sort of sexual model. He had, like, really what he was, the basis of his sort of advocacy was a freeing of the possibilities of love and sexuality. And so, you know, that certainly extended to sexual relations between people of the same sex. It also was very tied up culturally at the time in this effort to erase class distinctions. And that also became an important element in the trial where, you know, he was asked about, like, whether it was proper for him to associate with, you know, servants and sailors and, you know, whatever, basically working class men. And then he also explicitly, and this comes out in those plays, which were generally thought of as being frivolous and apolitical, was relentlessly critical of the sexual double standard where men were allowed a certain amount of autonomy and sort of, as long as they were discreet, were allowed a certain amount of sexual latitude, whereas women were expected to be, you know, these completely pure virginal figures until they were married, and at which point they immediately converted into a sort of dour mother kind of figure. And in one of his interviews, he was asked, so are you objecting to the idea that there would be one law for men and one law for women? And he said, oh, absolutely. I think there should be no law for anyone. So that's really the direction that his thought was headed.
Fair enough. Yeah, I saw this part. I was just doing a cursory read of the Wikipedia page really quickly, and I saw that, and that quote made me think of John Henry McKay a little bit at first, and then I did not see any reference to pederasty specifically within the page for Oscar Wilde, but I remembered reading stuff on McKay a while ago, coming across like a lot of, wow, when he was writing under Sajida, or Sajida, I'm not sure how it's pronounced, it was pretty specifically, these are little boys.
Yeah, more adolescent men were taste.
Yeah.
Again, now, like, it's hard to say whether that's, you know, how much more acceptable that is.
Yeah. Or what, I mean, what he was prosecuted for was not specifically, and so it didn't come up, pederasty, where he was.
Well, it couldn't have. I mean, they were certainly above the age of consent at the time.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Do you have a set date for publication for the book?
I don't yet. I'm talking to a publisher now, but it's nothing is certain there, so it's too early to really say.
Well, I look forward to seeing it on bookshelves, and thanks so much for joining us.
Well, thanks for asking me.
And And I'd like to take this opportunity. This is me from the present now, which will soon be me from the past. You're listening to Asheville Free Media, AshevilleFM.org. This is The Final Straw, and I'm Bursts. The show can also be heard, on KOWA LPFM in Olympia, Washington, and also on KXCF in Marshall, California, and KWTF out of Bodega Bay, California. You can find archives of the show, including the interview that you just heard with Christian Williams, on thefinalstrawradio.noblogs.org, and you can contact us for information or suggestions at thefinalstrawradio@riseup.net. Other stuff. Coming up next, if you're listening live, is the repeat of last week's episode of Slumber Party Slice Radio. I want to really, really quickly announce the Anti-Klan, Anti-Hate event, or First Annual Anti-Racist Conference, March 29th to 30th in Memphis, Tennessee. And a little more detail on that is... So far they've got... for one thing, it's Lorenzo Comboa Irvin, who we interviewed on the show. It's going to be his birthday. Details to be announced, but so far... They've got Lorenzo and Jonina Irvin, Daryl Lamont Jenkins from the One People's Party, and One People's Project, and Not For Profit are concerned to present, are confirmed to present. Sorry, I've got allergies, so
my nose is all stuffed up right now. It's very difficult to speak.
Much better. On April 25th through the 27th of 2014 in Dixon, Tennessee, there will be an anti-American Renaissance demo. Let's see. More details on that. You can find out stuff about this on Facebook, sadly. But I think you can also find details if you end up going onto One People's Party's website. One People's Project, excuse me. Daryl, sorry. Also, there is a benefit on the 28th if you're on the other side of the state. If you're not in Tennessee and not in Memphis, if you are in Durham, there will be a benefit for the Defense Fund for Luke O'Donovan at the Pinhook in Durham. It's presented by the Homosexual Agenda, and it will be a dance party that will make feet worthwhile. There will be a disco ball, rainbow puking pandas, makeout booth, DJ Dreamboat, Dusty Tech, Birdger. I don't understand this stuff. But anyway, it should be a really fun party. And Luke O'Donovan needs money for lawyers to be able to support his attempt to stave off the... So he was a victim of a stabbing on New Year's of, not this year, but the prior year, in Atlanta, Georgia. A number of men had been calling him faggot and other things, and ended up attacking him. He defended himself, allegedly, and a lot of the parties were hospitalized. And so those people decided to bring suit against Luke because... It was one person versus all these other people making charges. And Luke has denied an interest in bringing the legal system in to it, but is simply trying to defend himself and get charges dropped because he faces, up to five charges of 20 years each, assault with a deadly weapon. And so he could be in there for 100 years, hypothetically. So let Luke go.